I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Trump began his second State of the Union address last night, calling on Congress to, quote, reject the politics of revenge, resistance, and retribution. It should be noted that earlier in the day, he had called Senator Chuck Schumer a nasty son of a bitch, Joe Biden a terrible student, and claimed that former Senator John McCain's book had bombed when, in fact, it was a bestseller. Last night, Trump called for but did not demand a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, said it was time to withdraw from Afghanistan and Syria, saying that great nations do not fight endless wars, and proposed investing in infrastructure, cutting drug prices, curing childhood cancer, and ending the AIDS-HIV epidemic. The president faces a divided government with Speaker Nancy Pelosi in charge of an energized House with 40 new Democrats. His presidential campaign is also under multiple investigations, and his popularity has never topped 50% in the 2 years he's been in office. We have three guests and a bunch of clips to play for you in this hour of Radio Times, and let me introduce everybody. Osita Nwanevu is a staff writer at The New Yorker and joins us from the NPR Bureau in Washington, D.C. Osita, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Erin Cassess is with us here in our Philadelphia studio. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Delaware. Erin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. And David Barrett is with us as well. He's a professor of political science at Villanova University, has focused much of his work and career on writing about and investigating the intelligence community. David Barrett, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. You're
Thank
welcome.
You.
Osita, let me begin with you. What was your major takeaway from last night?
Well, we see Trump in his presidency trying to occupy a lot of the traditional roles of the president and really straining against the kind of decorum we kind of expect from presidents and struggling to reconcile that with his own personality. And we saw that with this speech, as we have with formal speeches from him in the past. As you said, his calls for unity last night were preceded by reports of a dinner or a lunch, I guess, he did with TV news anchors, in which he disparaged a lot of the Democrats. He said last night that he would like to see the administration work with to solve issues in a bipartisan fashion. So that was my main takeaway. It was classic Trump presidency, him trying to occupy the role of the president and deliver the kind of rhetoric people expect, while at the same time being very Trumpian in his sort of inherent contradictions and his antagonism of the opposing party.
And we'll pick up on that. Erin, let me get your response. And it was hard not to see the sea of women in white outfits.
Definitely using dress as a way to kind of make a statement about promoting a women's agenda moving forward among the female House Democrats. In terms of the speech, I felt like it was a long speech. It was on message, and it hit a lot of the topics we expected to hear about: immigration, foreign policies, calls for unity and bipartisanship. And then there were also a few more unexpected notes. So the comments about the Mueller investigation as a kind of potential obstacle to the economic miracle taking place in this country, some really strong language on abortion, and then kind of an unusual claim that the United States will never be a socialist nation, so this attack on socialism.
And the camera went to Bernie Sanders, I noticed.
Exactly. So it was a bit of a mixed bag in that respect.
And I'll pick up on that as well. David, let me get you in on the conversation. What was your major takeaway?
I found it disjointed. To some degree, Trump wants to be presidential in a State of the Union address, but he wanted to say the things to keep his base with him. And I think that three-quarters of the people watching last night were his base, because I noticed about a 75% approval. CBS did an instant poll, about a 75% approval, which means lots of Democrats and many independents were not watching. So there was a good deal of red meat mixed in, I thought, oddly, with the thing that presidents do of bringing in guests and paying tribute. And, you know, those were some touching moments.
They were,
no
question.
Really touching moments. But it's a difficult fit. So, on the whole, a long and in many ways an odd speech, but probably effective with his base.
Let me play the clip that Erin referenced, and this was early on in the speech. It's hard to summarize it because it's a interesting, rather confusing use of language here. But let's play it, and then let's talk about it.
If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way.
So, Osita, how did you take what the president was saying there?
Well, I mean, he likes rhyming. I think it's very similar to something Kellyanne Conway said early in the administration in a TV appearance. I mean, he is trying to adopt this sort of conciliatory... Well, not conciliatory isn't the word. He's trying to be somebody who represents unity, while at the same time acknowledging that with the House now in Democratic hands, he's going to be under the slings and arrows of the various investigations that are going to be put into the actions of the administration and the campaign. And he's trying to sort of frame that in a way that he can reconcile it with the sort of anti-partisanship language that presidents usually adopt. He's trying to suggest that Democrats, by doing investigations into very legitimate issues, are engaging in a kind of petty partisanship that presidents in these kinds of addresses usually try to criticize. And that's simply not really what's going on. You can't sort of marshal that rhetorical, you know, pattern and in a way that really dismisses the substance of what Democrats are trying to do with their investigations. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was a kind of weak aim at it being a weak way of trying to be presidential in a way that hit against the Russian investigation, which obviously has very legitimate reasons to be pursued.
Well, and Aaron, you had mentioned this earlier in the investigation legislation. I mean, there is some sort of rhyming that's going on within that sentence. But again, what are your thoughts?
It kind of reminded me of Jackie Childs from Seinfeld. He's got this like slogans and this kind of prosecutorial bent. So I thought it was strange, but kind of consistent with Trump's rhetoric about the Mueller investigation in the past. So some of my research...
Not witch hunt, though.
Well, some of my research has looked at the presidential rhetoric, and mostly it's involved analyzing those 150 witch hunt tweets. And in those tweets, about 40% mention an intelligence agency, a specific intelligence agent, or the Department of Justice. So he's kind of identifying these people as the witch hunters. It's part of this broader strategy to broadly discredit the intelligence community and the Justice Department, to cast this as a partisan motivation behind the investigation, and then right. on top of that, to kind of intervene in that process.
I'm sure, David, you want to weigh in on that as well, as someone who has spent a lot of years investigating and writing about the intelligence community.
Presidents always have somewhat difficult relations with the intelligence establishment. It's the job of the intelligence people to tell the president what they know as best they can determine it, what the truth is about conditions and events around the world. That's their job. It annoys presidents, all of them. The difference is all other presidents, if you look at Franklin Roosevelt through Obama, they keep their dissatisfaction private. I've listened to tape recordings of President Kennedy calling his CIA director a horse's ass, stupid, and some other things.
And this was all behind closed doors.
Yes. President Trump, a week or so ago, was saying that his intelligence leaders need to go back to school and they're naive. But then they had a meeting and they their job is to tell him the truth, but it's also to somehow keep decent relations, and so they're in a bit of a dilemma. When he made the statement last night that if his opponent, that would be Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. had won, we would now be at war or have had a war with North Korea, and I thought, who told him that? I'm certain the intelligence community did not. Did Kim Jong-un tell him that? I don't know. Coming from any other president, that was a statement that would have made headlines. But, you know, there's so many interesting things that he says, they can't all be headlines.
Well, let's play that clip. And this was later on in last night's State of the Union. And just as David Barrett said, this is what President Trump said about North Korea.
If I had not been elected president of the United States, we would right now, in my opinion, be in a major war with North Korea.
So, Osita, you can hear some rumbling there in the background. How did you take that message?
Well, I was there in the chamber, and there was definitely scoffing on the Democratic side when he said that. I mean, it's an extraordinary statement, as was just said. If any other president had said it, it would have been in the news for days and days and days. I can't really imagine another president making a kind of a claim, and there's absolutely nothing to it. I think that, frankly, this administration, for the most part, even though there has been progress made with North Korea, has been characterized by a lot of anxiety about what's going on in the peninsula. People were very, very frightened about the situation last year, but, you know, I guess Trump has powers of you know, clairvoyance or something. I don't really know how else to characterize that.
And he is meeting with the North Korean leader, you know, in a month or so. Yeah, David.
You know, I'm not his speechwriter, right, but it would have been, I think, better, maybe even more effective, if he had made the point, talking is better than fighting. And we have been talking in the Trump era with North Korea, and there's a very good case to be made that that's a very good thing. There are dangers. We don't want to be naive dealing with them, and that's a real risk, and I wonder if that's going on. But talking beats fighting. So, you know, congratulations to him for that at least. But no, he has to make this claim that we would be at war, which is just an extravagant, impossible-to-prove statement.
Aaron, let me go back to you, and you mentioned language and witch hunt, and it's always interesting to hear the president speak either with a teleprompter or without one, mm-hmm. and the kind of words that he comes back to time and time again, and wasn't so much on display last night, but there's a certain linguistic style that he has.
Right, so some linguists have studied his vocabulary and argue that he has relatively limited word use, so you do see this kind of repetition, and it functions to kind of drive home his messaging and make sure that it's kind of very concise, mm-hmm. I suppose. Mm-hmm. So witch hunt is one of those things that shows up again and again. The references to the caravans as a rhetorical tool.
Which he did last night.
Right. So, and I think that was kind of expected. That's been a go-to for him. Sure.
Yeah. And we're almost up in a break here, but I'm curious about when you saw that frame, and it's always interesting, you got the president in front, you've got the vice president, and whoever the Speaker of the House is, they're all in this tableau together. What did you see, Aaron?
Well, I think before the speech, there was a lot of kind of speculation about how Pelosi was going to look and how she was going to school her face. And to some extent, that kind of is part of a tendency to hyper-police women's faces, women's expressions. The panels I was listening to after the speech talked about how she was biting her lip. There were a couple of instances in which she was kind of waving to the delegation, maybe to silence some of the groaning or rowdiness. I think there's also this big contrast between Pelosi's face and Pence's face.
Absolutely. His face doesn't change.
No, I feel like he kind of gets church face, where he kind of settles in, and he was reading off the teleprompter versus Pelosi, who seemed to be reading off a hard copy of the speech. But she definitely came across as a more active listener, right, kind of behind Trump than Pence did.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about last night's State of the Union address. We'll also be talking about the response from Stacey Abrams as well. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, doing what much of the country is doing this morning, which is deconstructing the president's State of the Union address last night. And again, we will be talking about the response from Stacey Abrams, who was a Democratic candidate for governor of Georgia. David Barrett from Villanova University, our guest Aaron Kesses from the University of Delaware, and down at the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. is Osita Nuanevu, and he's a staff writer at The New Yorker. Aaron, you wanted to say something just about the Mueller reference.
Sure. So I think another question about that kind of reference is, how does the public react to it? And there is some polling data that asks whether the Mueller investigation is a witch hunt or a fair investigation. So some polling data from December from NPR and Marist shows that only 17% of Republicans think it's a fair investigation, compared to 82% of Democrats. But at the same time, a majority of Americans want the investigation to continue, and that includes 51% of Republicans. Americans also want the report to be made public, and that includes 68% of Republicans. So to me, this suggests that even though Republicans may not fully trust the process, they would rather see President Trump vindicated by it than see it fall apart, right? Which is why it's been important for Trump to keep loyalists, you know, very close to the Department of Justice investigation.
Well, that's fascinating and good to know. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Let me play another clip from last night. And there was the president spoke a lot, I would say, gave immigration probably more time than almost any other issue from last night. And let me just play a portion of what he said about undocumented immigrants.
No issue better illustrates the divide between America's working class and America's political class than illegal immigration. Wealthy politicians and donors push for open borders while living their lives behind walls and gates and guards. Meanwhile, working class Americans are left to pay the price for mass illegal immigration.
Well, see, I thought that was so interesting because we are learning from the Washington Post and the New York Times about the number of undocumented immigrants who have been worked, they're now being fired, but who have worked for years at Trump properties. And a man talking about wealthy people living behind walls. It seems to me that describes our president.
Well, yeah, you know, if illegal immigrants were as dangerous as Trump routinely says they are, I don't think they'd make very good employees for the Trump organization. I mean, this is the kind of rhetoric we've heard from this president, from the beginning of his administration. I think the claim that people who support more liberal immigration policy are people who themselves live in sort of guarded enclaves is something that you hear a lot on Fox News from people like Tucker Carlson. It's an extremely odd claim. The people who support more liberal immigration policy also happen to live in the places where there are more immigrants than there are in the rest of the country. And this idea that illegal immigration is something that's being foisted on conservative America while liberals don't really want immigrants in their neighborhoods or in their communities is just simply not true. Everybody who lives in places like New York or D.C. or Chicago knows this not to be true. But it's part of the reality that you know, has been created in part, or I guess jointly, by this administration and conservative media about people's motivations for supporting you know, immigration reform.
And David, just to add to the drama, of course, the government shutdown was over funding for the border wall. There is a deadline coming up of February 15th of coming up with some kind of budget for the government and whether the wall or whatever it's called now will be included or not. How do you see that?
Can I just say something about what the president
said? Absolutely.
In that clip, he showed his skill, which is considerable, to relate to his base. Personally, there are things that he said in the speech last night that I agree with, but that particular statement puts his rhetorical skill on display. You could call it rhetorical skill, or you could call it demagoguery. I think he is uniquely skilled at exaggerations and falsehoods. One of the most skillful political figures, I don't approve of it, but one of the most skillful political figures at speaking to his supporters and you know, sort of rousing them. The other part of your question was
right
about the shutdown. The president is acting as if a president can simply force Congress to appropriate money, which is not quite how it works. I mean, it's, you know, presidents can apply pressure, yes, and Congress across the decades has given presidents a good deal of freedom to reallocate money that they have appropriated. So, you know, he's got something going on in this struggle, but it's not clear to me that he's going to win, and especially it's not clear to me that most Republicans are going to go along. If he wants to declare a national emergency and start using those monies, Democrats, I think, will be almost 100% against that in the Congress. But I think there will be significant Republican defections because this will be I think we'll have a constitutional crisis if he tries to do that. And I'm certainly not convinced that all Republicans in Congress want that.
Well, and it's clear that Nancy Pelosi, Erin, she's ready for the fight.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's come out very strong and very consistent in her opposition to the border wall, and I don't see it. Any reason that would change anytime soon. And I think this clip is an interesting choice to pull out of Trump's immigration comments, because so much of it was kind of stale and recycled material that we've already heard before. And this little piece that kind of grafts class onto the argument is the one piece that was really something new. He identifies working class voters as the primary victims of illegal immigration.
And there's some truth to that, isn't there?
Well,
I mean, not like boldly, dramatically, but when you look at undocumented immigrants, it tends to be people sort of working poor and working class that has to compete with them for jobs.
I mean, to some extent, I think that the argument was more about symbolic competition than a realistic competition. Like kind of in the same way that the caravan is being used to raise the specter of a security threat, this kind of job threat is the economic threat that's being raised here. Right. But I think it might be an interesting preview of how Trump's immigration discussion is going to shift moving forward, especially into 2020, to talk about class.
Yeah, go ahead, David. I'll get you back into the conversation.
I'm not an economic specialist, but I do readings on this subject. And my sense of it is that there's not that much job competition. My sense of it, I lived in Texas for a number of years. I have friends and relatives, and they're in the interesting position of claiming that they cannot get people to do things like yard work unless they hire people that they know to be
that
undocumented. So I think it's interesting to me, many of the undocumented persons who've come into this country are willing to do work that others of us who've lived here a long time don't want to do.
Osita, you're down there in Washington. We're, about 10 days away or so from some kind of a deadline. What do you anticipate?
Well, I mean, we were at a point last week where people kind of expecting or anticipating that this speech might include a declaration of a national emergency that would allow Trump to sort of build the wall on his own. He didn't do that, but that seems to be, honestly, still a very possible outcome. I don't know that Democrats are going to be any more willing to relent on the issue of the wall than they were last week or when the shutdown actually ended. So I don't really know what progress can be made if the president and the Democrats are firmly set in their positions about the wall. I don't think either side is going to really give up.
Right.
So Trump might be in a situation where he's going to have to do something extraordinary.
Which would be another government shutdown or these emergency powers?
Well, using these emergency powers. I don't know that he would be willing to go through with another shutdown. Certainly Republicans in Congress don't want to see another one. They were, I think, badly hurt by what happened. So I think it honestly, Democrats aren't going to be any more willing to give up, even if there is another shutdown. Mm-hmm. We saw different labor groups, federal workers organize in the middle of the last one to really put the pressure on the administration. I think one of the precipitating events that ended things, or nearly, contributed to things ending, was a situation you saw with air traffic controllers and flight attendants, maybe suggesting that a major part of our nation's infrastructure was going to be undermined if this continued. That's only going to happen again if a shutdown happens a second time. So I don't know. If I'm a betting person, I'll say that the Trump probably goes to the national emergency, which would be an extraordinary move.
It certainly would. Let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. That's Osita Nwanevu, and he's a staff writer for The New Yorker. Erin Cassess is with us here in our Philadelphia studios. She's associate professor of political science at the University of Delaware. David Barrett is a professor of political science at Villanova University and has written a number of books about the intelligence community and a number of different presidents. And you can join us. We're talking about last night's State of the Union address, 1-888-477-9499. You can email us, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Comment from Mike says, there was not one mention of climate change in the address. I don't know. Did you, Erin, expect the president to talk about climate change last night?
No, not necessarily. Bernie Sanders mentioned it in his rebuttal and also mentioned its omission in the president's address.
Interesting. A comment from Kate. The only reason Trump is still talking about immigration is to scare his base into voting for him again. That's all this is about. Do you see it that way, David? You mentioned that it is an issue that appeals to the base.
It absolutely is. I think the polling shows that. And I think he has a conviction. I don't think he's being completely cynical. I think he's convinced himself. It's not uncommon for political leaders, politicians, not just presidents, to persuade themselves that they're speaking the truth sometimes. But it is very much speaking to his base. The climate change thing, like, what's he going to say? I think there's discomfort on the part of even a number of his supporters. I think they know there's climate change and believe it probably is caused by human beings. So I'm not sure I don't think he saw any real reason to speak to it. But it's remarkable that an issue of such importance goes unmentioned in a State of the Union address.
And it often goes unmentioned in presidential debates and interviews with candidates. It is, I mean, curiously, Aaron, it doesn't seem to resonate with people who have microphones.
There is some buzz, I think, around the Green New Deal and this idea of linking economic policy and environmental policy. And you've seen some candidates like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez come out and support it. So I think it's possible that something like that can gain some traction moving into 2020.
Well, speaking of some of the women in Congress, let me play one more clip from the president last night. And this was his reference to the fact that women got the vote about 100 years ago and many more women who are certainly in the House of Representatives.
And exactly one century after Congress passed the constitutional amendment giving women the right to vote, we also have more women serving in Congress than at any time before.
Long applause there, Osita. It was an interesting moment last night. Mm-hmm. What did you observe?
Well, there was a lot of Democratic women trying to take advantage of those lines to really sort of cheer for themselves and what's been a remarkable accomplishment for the Democratic Party, which is dramatically increasing the number of women in the caucus over the past several years. And I mean, it could not be more stark, the difference between the Republican side and the Democratic side in that chamber, with all of the Democratic women wearing white, to sort of show visually how many women there are who are part of the policymaking conversation in the Democratic Party. So that was a really important moment, I think, and one that Democrats relished in making theirs.
Well, and I think you could also see just the racial and ethnic diversity between the two parties as well, Aaron. Yeah. You know, they sit on both sides of the chamber, so you can sit there and look and just see how different these two parties are.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are 47 women of color in Congress and, you know, on the Democratic side of the aisle. One thing that kind of goes unacknowledged from Trump's comments is that the number of Republican women in the House delegation has fallen. So it fell from 23 to 13. And kind of building an eligibility pool for Republican women candidates has increasingly become a problem. There's not a lot of demand for female representation from within the party. So you don't have the same kind of mechanism for building a strong pool that you do on the Democratic side.
Dave, let me go back to you and just the president spoke about some foreign policy issues near the end of the almost hour and a half that he spoke last night. What do you think? And we played the clip about North Korea. What about the Middle East? And he said an interesting thing that it's hard to disagree with, I think, is that great nations don't fight endless wars. We have been in Afghanistan since 2001.
Right. I said earlier there are portions of the speech that I personally agree with. You know, I think this is a significant point. Endless wars.
Right.
And I think he is right. He has sometimes said that to the extent we have a foreign policy establishment in this country, they seem okay with these wars that go on forever. So I think this is a point that people, not just his base, I think a lot of people can relate to, including liberal Democrats. It makes them uncomfortable agreeing with President Trump, but the fact is that a number of them do. And I think substantively, although I don't have some miracle idea for precisely how the U.S. can withdraw from Afghanistan, and of course Syria is its own particular set of problems, but I think this is, especially Afghanistan, my God, it's a long time since 2001.
Sure is. And the U.S. is talking to the Taliban, interestingly.
Right, which, again, positive development, potentially very positive development. And it's good to keep that in mind as we ponder the number of Americans. He gave the number, I think, who died in both Iraq and Afghanistan. But and the fact that in Afghanistan especially, we're still very much there. And I think reasonable people ask, why? Right. President Trump asked that question. So do a lot of other people.
Can we squeeze in just your comments about Iran? The president withdrawing from the deal negotiated with President Obama and other allies.
Well, I think we, the American people, knew something like that. We knew what we were getting with Donald Trump with regard to Iran. For me, the most interesting thing, and of course it reflects my own research and writing interest, is that the intelligence community, as it's referred to, has said to, in effect, said to this president, as they did late in President Bush's term, look, Iran is not doing the things that you are claiming. They actually are, at least they put it technically, abiding by the agreement. So there is a significant disconnect between this president and the U.S. intelligence community.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Shift gears here, and we'll be talking about the Democratic response to the State of the Union address last night, and we'll be talking about Stacey Abrams. We've got a couple of clips set up as well. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Last night, Stacey Abrams, who lost her bid for governor of Georgia, delivered the Democratic response to President Trump's speech. She's a rising star in the Democratic Party and the first African-American woman to ever give a rebuttal to the State of the Union address. This is often a thankless job, and most speakers really cannot match the pomp and ritual of the State of the Union. We're going to carry on our conversation with Osita Nwanevu, with Aaron Cassess and David Barrett, and with you. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. President Trump said this was before the speech, Aaron. I respect her, referring to Stacey Abrams. I don't know her. I haven't met her, but I hope she does a good job. How did she do?
I thought she did a great job. It was a strong rebuttal. It actually wasn't what I expected. I had just read her essay in Foreign Affairs, which was kind of an explanation and a defense of identity politics. But her message was more about unity and community. And she had a great line in her speech I really liked called "The Uncommon Grace of Community." So in some ways, she was trying to strike, you know, a similar note to the State of the Union address, but just went about it in a very different way. But I thought it was a really sharp and resonant kind of speech.
Let me play a clip from Stacey Abrams, and again, part of the Democratic response to the State of the Union, where she mentions the fact that during the government shutdown, she was one of the people that helped distribute meals to federal workers.
Just a few weeks ago, I joined volunteers to distribute meals to furloughed federal workers. They waited in line for a box of food and a sliver of hope since they hadn't received paychecks in weeks. Making livelihoods of our federal workers a pawn for political games is a disgrace. The shutdown was a stunt engineered by the President of the United States, one that defied every tenet of fairness and abandoned not just our people, but our values.
Well, Sita, that's strong language.
It was very strong language, and I thought it was a good speech. You know, this phrase that she uses towards the beginning, the uncommon grace of community, was sort of the theme, and I think her rendering of the shutdown as a betrayal of that commitment that we have to each other was powerful. I think the issue and I think this is true across Democratic rhetoric, is that they will say things like, you know, we need to come together and bring ourselves together as a country to achieve some common purpose, and then also criticize the Republican Party in ways that make it very clear how stark the differences are that need to be bridged and make clear how difficult it'll be to bridge them without really suggesting how that's going to be done. I think one good example of this in this speech is when Abrams talks very compellingly about voter suppression. You know, her campaign for governor was, I think, characterized by a lot of controversy about the extent to which voters were being suppressed in Georgia, and this is something that African American voters across the South are facing at the hands of Republican administrations who have made it harder for people in those communities to vote. It's very hard to sort of reconcile this sort of hope and promise of unity and bipartisanship that get talked about in these kinds of speeches with the realities that they also criticize of politics on the ground in actuality.
Well, David, I thought it was interesting. She said, you know, in Georgia, when we disagree about things, we don't shut our government down. We, you know, we try to figure out how to keep it open and how to resolve some of our differences.
You know, in last fall, there were so many interesting, important campaigns in so many states. It took me a while to tune into Georgia. Now, I'm from the Deep South originally, so it was only a matter of time. My mother was from Georgia. I'm born and raised in Louisiana. And when I finally did tune into Georgia in that race, I thought, wow, she is a really impressive candidate. She is more articulate than the run-of-the-mill candidate for governor, senator, whatever. And so I was not surprised that she gave an effective speech last night. It did remind me last night, there's a good reasoning behind having the response from the party that is out of power, because she raised issues that were completely ignored by President Trump. And she did it effectively. Probably people sitting at this table can easily recall there have been responses to this
very awkward
by
responses.
Republicans and Democrats,
and Democrats
that were ineffective and sometimes laughably ineffective, almost memorably ineffective, if that's a thing.
Oh, to be memorably ineffective. I got it.
Marco Rubio some years back when he had his bottle of water that he was swigging during the talk. You know, bad idea.
Aaron, let me go back to you, and this is a more political question, but, you know, where would the Democratic Party be without African-American women?
Well, I mean,
aren't they the kind of, you know, the
I want to just say lost, but
the mainstay?
Yeah, I mean, something about Abrams in particular that I wanted to raise, and her selection to give this speech, is that after the 2018 midterms, after the primaries and after the elections, I got a lot of questions from journalists about, like, what's going to happen to the women that lose? Like, are they just going to, like, kind of disappear and go back to wherever they came from? And there's a literature on this in political science about how do we recruit and retain strong female candidates. And I think, like, selecting Abrams for this role, giving her a national platform, encouraging her to run against incumbent Republican Senator David Perdue, and making sure the donors are behind her is a perfect example of how to recruit and retain talent and help encourage women to run for higher office, even if they're unsuccessful the first time. So I think it was also important in that respect, beyond, you know, the quality of the speech that she gave.
Osita, if you can respond, I thought she was an interesting choice, maybe a very smart choice, coming from the Democrats, but at the same time, we know what African-American women mean to this party.
Oh, absolutely, and a very different choice than Steve Beshear and Joe Kennedy in the past couple of years. I mean, it's definitely signals a shift that the party has made, I think, given the results of the midterm elections, which showed just how powerful candidates of color and female candidates were in delivering Democrats their majority in the House. Now, I mean, in the Trump administration, there was still this debate happening in the party about whether it should do more to reach out to sort of Trump's base, white working class voters. I think the Beshear State of the Union response was directly, you know, I think in tune with that conversation. I joked at the time that maybe the next response would be delivered from the bottom of a coal mine shaft in West Virginia. But now we see an entirely different approach. Even though she didn't talk about identity politics, politics. You talked a little bit about it, but I mean, I think we see now that the party has sort of fully embraced the importance of representation in driving turnout from communities that don't always turn out because they don't feel like the political system has a place for them, and they don't feel that they have leaders that look like them and share their concerns. I think that they've now fully understood and embraced the importance of putting people forward who look like people from these communities.
Let me play one more clip from Stacey Abrams last night, and this was near the end of her speech. And David, I'll give you a chance to respond. Let's give it a listen.
Even as I am very disappointed by the president's approach to our problems, I still don't want him to fail. But we need him to tell the truth and to respect his duties and respect the extraordinary diversity that defines America.
What do you make of that, David?
Well, this whole matter of truth-telling versus whether you want to call them lies or falsehoods, I think it's a good thing that the Washington Post, which he hates, literally keeps track on a day-to-day basis the number.
And they fact-checked his speech last night.
Right, yeah. So I think that's a good point to make. You know, Mr. President, tell the truth. Look, we understood the package with Donald Trump when the election was occurring, and he won the presidency. And there is, I judge, a real problem. I'm far from the first to ever say this. Mm-hmm. He has a problem with the truth. Even, you know, you mentioned it's a small thing, I guess, but his trashing John McCain in that luncheon yesterday and saying, oh, well, his book was a dud. It's just simply not true. And I'm sure he knows it's not true.
Osita, anything you want to add to that?
No, I mean, we all know that the president is not an honest person. I don't know if there's anything, any news being broken there. I mean, I do think that, you know, one thing I've always sort of wondered in listening to Democrats respond to the president is the extent to which they isolate him as a particular problem, rather than talking about the Republican Party, I guess, as opponents and antagonists. And I think that Abrams struck an interesting balance in talking about the president, but also making clear that, again, with voter suppression, that there are things being done at the hands of Republican administrations by blaming Republicans for the shutdown. So I don't know. I think the Democrats, on the one hand, feel pressure, just sort of ideologically, to isolate Trump as an enemy or somebody who's an opponent of progress, so that they can then say to Republicans, you can divorce yourself from the president and join us. On the other hand, facing the sort of standard partisan differences in priorities having that difference of the parties play out. So I don't know. I think that Abrams...
It's tricky.
It is tricky.
It's a tricky. It's a tricky navigational challenge, I would say there. But right. Do you think? Let me just go quickly back to you, Osita. But do you think that the Republican Party is the party of Trump?
Well, I think that's absolutely the case. I think that's clear if you look at Trump's approval numbers among Republicans. That he basically owns the party, and it's made it very, very hard for Republican legislators to divorce themselves from him. But I will say, too, that the other reason why it's hard for them to divorce themselves from him is that they agree with him on a lot of policy issues. The sort of basic Republican program of tax cuts and deregulation, Trump agrees with that. They agree with that, too. So I think that the Republican Party was always sort of, you know, trending in a direction well before Trump came on the scene where there would be more... less amenable to immigration, where there would be more and more racial anxiety characterizing the views of the people that they elected. And I think that Trump is the culmination of that. And I think that Democrats, on one hand, as I said, feel the need to reach out to Republicans and have them break away from Trump. On the other hand, will still face these sort of core definitional differences as they try to do that.
David, you want to add something? And Aaron, I've got a question for you.
Just briefly, what's most interesting are those issues where Republicans have simply flipped because of Trump. Trade, foreign policy, they've just flipped in favor of Trump. The Republican Party used to be, on the whole, of the two parties, the party favoring free trade. Not anymore. It's become much more of a protectionist party, and it's because of him and the popularity of him with his base, which forces members of Congress and other Republicans simply to shift, and they've shifted, and I find it fascinating, and it's not the only issue.
You know, Aaron, it was interesting last night just to see, I've lost count actually how many Democrats are running for president, at least so far, including some semi-half-declared presidents, and a number of them are women, which is interesting. But there they were milling among their colleagues, and it was hard to kind of not think about what was going on in their heads.
Yeah, I mean, I think my mind kind of immediately goes to imagining how these women are going to perform in debates against Trump, and so kind of seeing their watching their
the matchup and sort of
yeah, their kind of like micro expressions and some of the you know, some of the stronger bodily reactions to some of Trump's comments were interesting. I think it's exciting that so many women are going to be running. In political science, we don't have a lot of research on races where women run against other women because there are so few women candidates. So usually it's women running against men. And one of the things I think we're really going to get out of these candidacies is a more nuanced understanding of how women kind of articulate their gender and use gender in their campaigns. We have an oversimplified way of talking about women candidates now, and we kind of say, are they running as a woman or are they running as a man, as if there's like one way to fit into each of those boxes. And we say Clinton ran as a man in 2008 and then a woman in 2016 and it didn't work either way, so I don't know what her other option was. But I think with these kind of particularly the senators that are running, we're already seeing very kind of divergent ways of integrating gender into campaigns and using gender strategically.
And women are not a monolith. We should add to our, just so people know.
Right.
Let me read a comment from Tammy. She says, I love everything Abrams had to say, except for the fact that she also failed to address climate change or the Green New Deal in any substantial way. And I'm just curious, Osita, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, so there is one line about climate change in sort of a paragraph towards the end of the speech where she talks about things that hadn't been mentioned before, but that's just about it. I mean, I think the Democratic Party is being forced to address the issue more and more by activists and working on a piece now about the Green New Deal resolution, which we can expect to read, being put out by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey, I think, pretty soon. But look, this is the issue of our time. I think that's going to be very clear to future generations if that's not clear to us right now. And I don't know that the Democratic Party, for all its talk about believing science, which is obviously very important, mm-hmm. Has done really very much to craft an actual strategy or a plan that they can put forward should they win the presidency in 2020 and find themselves in a position to do something. So, you know, I my hope certainly is that it figures more largely in speeches by the 2020 candidates and other figures moving forward, but there wasn't very much about it in Abrams' speech now.
David, we're almost out of time, but we're not going to become a socialist country, according to President Trump.
I don't think this is an issue for most of the nation. Again, I think it speaks to his base. You know, this is an old line that Republicans have used. You could go back 50, 60, 70 years ago against the Democrats. There's not much new there. It's kind of amusing to watch this claim being made. I don't think it has much effect on election outcomes.
Well, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. It will be interesting to watch the next couple of years as some of these issues get played out. Osita Nwanevu, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker. Aaron Cassess, thank you for coming in and joining us as well.
Thanks.
You're welcome. And she's associate professor of political science at the University of Delaware. David Barrett, thank you for joining us
as well. My pleasure.
And he's a professor of political science at Villanova University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.